Welcome to the deep dive. Have you ever read a piece of writing that starts out as a pretty gritty, relatable drama and then pivots into a miraculous spiritual awakening and then just violently crashes into apocalyptic body horror?
All within, what, a few paragraphs?
Yeah, exactly. All within a few paragraphs. Because today we are unpacking a narrative that will give you absolute
It
whiplash.
really will.
Today, we are immersing ourselves for you, the listener, in this incredibly intense, almost fever dream of a narrative excerpt. It's simply titled Liteti Teksti, which translates from Finnish to attached text.
And I just want to say right up front, it is a phenomenal piece of writing. It
Yes.
operates as this like masterclass in narrative shock.
Oh,
Yeah,
totally.
but more importantly, I think it raises a really core conceptual question that we see echoed a lot in, psychology, mythology, and theology.
Which is what exactly?
Well, it's the question of why profound psychological or spiritual change almost always seems to trigger an immediate violent backlash.
Right, and that is the exact thesis we are chasing today. The primary excerpt features a protagonist named Toivo, and it concludes with a deeply disturbing section attributed to Outopi Huttu.
Yeah, the transition there is jarring.
Extremely. And the mission for our deep dive today is to dissect this incredibly jarring narrative journey. We're going to explore how this text uses radical, neck-snapping tonal shifts.
Moving from like mundane hungover depression right into divine salvation.
And then dropping you directly into demonic torture. It is such a visceral experience. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the purgatory of Toivo's waking reality.
Yeah, the story opens with Toivo waking up, and the author establishes his physical and mental state with just ruthless
Ooh, it's
efficiency.
so bleak.
It is. He wakes up in his apartment, and the air is thick with smoke. His head is throbbing, and he is just surrounded by the detritus of a severe bender. He stands up, and empty cans crunch beneath his feet.
I actually want to pause on that hangover for a second because I think it's really easy to read that and just think, oh, okay, the guy drinks too much.
Right, just a casual character detail.
Exactly. But the physical reality of a severe hangover, if you look at it from a physiological perspective, is essentially a state of acute withdrawal and neurological panic.
Oh, absolutely. The brain is freaking out.
It is. When someone drinks heavily, alcohol suppresses the central nervous system. It acts on GABA receptors to slow things down. But the brain, trying to maintain homeostasis, overcompensates by ramping up glutamate.
Which is an excitatory neurotransmitter, right?
Right, exactly. So when the alcohol wears off, you're left with this massive glutamate rebound. Your brain is essentially redlining.
That's a great way to put it.
So that throbbing head, the hypersensitivity to sound, like, the crunching cans, the physical nausea, it's a chemical manifestation of deep anxiety and systemic stress.
And that physiological context is so crucial here. He isn't just tired, his nervous system is screaming at him. And the author pairs this biological distress with these incredibly specific environmental cues.
Like the wine glass.
Yeah, Toivo tastes a wine glass left on the table from the night before, and he gags because it tastes truly awful.
Yeah.
The environment he is waking up in is a direct, tangible reflection of his internal state. It is chaotic. It is toxic, and it's suffocating.
I see that, but could it also just be the harsh, literal reality of poverty and severe addiction? I mean, sometimes a dirty room is just a dirty room. What elevates it to a metaphor here for you, rather than just strict, gritty realism?
I think it elevates to metaphor because of the sensory isolation.
What do you mean?
Well, the smoke in the air isn't just a byproduct of cigarettes. It actually obscures his vision. In literature, when a character's immediate environment mirrors their internal psychological state, we refer to it as an objective correlative.
Okay. Objective correlative.
Right, so the smoke is the literal fog in his mind. He cannot see clearly physically in his room, which, foreshadows the fact that he cannot see his own future. He is trapped in this closed loop of his own decay.
And while he's standing there holding his throbbing head and dealing with this huge glutamate rebound, he starts trying to piece together the sleep he just emerged from.
Yeah, the dream fragments.
Right. He wonders what kind of crazy dreams he was having. And the text gives us three very specific, very strange fragments. He asks himself, what greenstones? What guardian angel? And me getting married?
It's such a fascinating triad of images. They seem completely divorced from the grim reality of empty beer cans and stale wine.
They really do. And I have to wonder, are these just the meaningless, randomized static of a hungover brain misfiring? Or, you know, are we looking at narrative foreshadowing?
I definitely lean toward foreshadowing.
Same. Because if you break them down, the guardian angel could easily be predicting the strangers, you know, the literal saviors he's about to meet by the river.
That makes perfect sense.
And getting married imagery, marriage in a spiritual context across almost all major religions, symbolizes a union with the divine. It's the making of a sacred covenant.
Yeah, the mystical marriage.
Exactly. In the Christian tradition, which this text heavily leans into later, the church is often referred to as the bride of Christ. So Toivo dreaming of a wedding could literally be his subconscious preparing for the spiritual union he's about to experience.
That is a highly perceptive reading.
Mm-hmm.
In existential literature, and specifically if we look at this through the lens of Carl Jung's analytical psychology, dreams are never just static.
Right. Jung was all about the symbolism.
Exactly. Jung believed dreams are the psyche's attempt to communicate vital information to the conscious mind, often using these universal archetypes. The conscious mind might be obsessed with the hangover, but the unconscious mind is signaling a massive impending shift.
But what about the green stones? That's the one that trips me up a bit.
Oh, that's actually the most interesting one.
Because angels and marriage make sense in a religious allegory, but green stones feel, I don't know, kind of out of left field.
Green stones are perhaps the most ancient archetype of the three, actually. If you look at historical lapidary.
I was the lapidary.
Oh, they were medieval texts that assigned symbolic and magical properties to different gems.
Oh, fascinating. Okay.
So in lapidaries, green stones like emeralds or jade almost universally represent healing, alchemy, and resurrection.
No way.
Yeah. In some alchemical traditions, the philosopher's stone, which grants eternal life, is associated with a deep, radiant green.
Wow.
And furthermore, in the book of Revelation, the throne of God is described as being surrounded by a rainbow that resembles an emerald.
That is wild. I had no idea about the Revelation connection.
Right. So the green stones introduce an element of the surreal, the alchemical, and the divine. They hint that the bizarre supernatural events to come are already bleeding into his subconscious before he even leaves the apartment.
It's almost like his soul's early warning system is firing off. But his conscious brain can only process it as a vague, confusing memory.
Exactly.
And the conscious mind's immediate reaction to these profound symbols is just sheer existential dread. Because right after recalling these dreams, Toivo has a very grim realization.
Yeah, he does.
He looks around and thinks, at this rate, I'll die before I'm 30.
That line establishes the stakes of the entire narrative immediately. We're dealing with terror management theory here.
Okay, remind me how terror management theory works in this context.
Well, it's a psychological concept proposing that most human behavior is ultimately motivated by a deep-seated subconscious fear of our own mortality.
Right.
Toivo's defenses have been totally stripped away by the addiction. He is looking at his trajectory and seeing an imminent, unavoidable terminus. He has basically diagnosed his own terminal spiritual illness.
And that sheer terror is the catalyst, isn't it? It forces him to act. He can't stay in that smoke-filled room with his own thoughts anymore. So he calls his friend, Mike. He is actively seeking an escape.
And the text highlights his isolation, even in this attempt at connection. The phone rings for a really long time.
Exactly. It's not an immediate lifeline. And when Mike finally answers, Toivo's pitch is simple and honestly bleak. He just says, let's go drink at the Riverside Park.
Nothing glamorous about it.
Right. Then Toivo throws on a torn denim jacket and stumbles down the apartment stairs. I actually want to dig into that detail, the torn denim jacket, because clothing in these kinds of tight narratives is rarely an accident.
Oh, the sociology of clothing is highly relevant here. Denim is historically a working class fabric. It implies durability, ruggedness, and a certain blue-collar resilience.
Yeah, it's supposed to be tough.
But Toivo's jacket is torn. It's compromised. It's his chosen armor for facing the world, representing a perhaps slightly rebellious identity, but it offers very little actual protection from the elements.
Whether those elements are physical cold or, you know, spiritual decay, frayed armor for a frayed man.
That's a great way to put it.
Thanks. So as he walks out, he passes a car downstairs, blasting music, adding to the sensory overload. Then he gets into Mike's car, and Mike says something incredibly specific.
He does.
He doesn't just say, hey. He says, I found a good song. It talks about a river. Hop in and let's go.
The river. This is where the text's symbolism begins to truly swell, demanding our full attention.
It's so deliberate.
Across human literature, philosophy, and mythology, rivers are rarely just bodies of water.
Right, but why? Like, what is it about moving water that makes human beings immediately jump to deep existential metaphors?
Well, because a river embodies the ultimate paradox of existence. It is a permanent fixture that is constantly changing.
Oh, like the Heraclitus quote.
Exactly. The ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus famously said, "You cannot step into the same river twice, for it is not the same river, and he is not the same man."
I love that quote.
It's perfect for this. Rivers represent the relentless forward momentum of time. Geographically and mythologically, they function as boundaries. You cross the river Styx to enter the underworld. You cross the river Lethe to forget your earthly life.
Or the River Jordan to enter the Promised Land?
Precisely. Or to undergo baptism. Crossing a river means crossing from one state of being to another.
And Mike's song acting as what we call a diegetic soundtrack to this drive, which for you listening just means the song is actually playing in the physical world of the characters, not just background music added for the reader's benefit.
Right, they are literally listening to it.
It underscores that Toivo is approaching a critical threshold. The text is blurring the lines between the mundane reality of two guys going to drink and the epic mythological journey Toivo is actually embarking on.
And the sheer normalcy of the setup is what makes it so tense.
It really reminds me of the pacing in a horror movie just before the monster attacks, or a drama right before a car crash.
Yes.
The casual drive, the mundane plan to just go drink at a park, you're watching a character casually walk toward a tripwire.
Because the emotional contrast is building toward a necessary breaking point. They get to the Riverside Park, they were sitting on a bench, and Toivo reflects on his internal state. He describes his life with three devastating words: empty, depressing, and dark.
It's the absolute void.
It is. The author is taking Toivo to his absolute emotional nadir. He's entirely hollowed out.
Why do you think that's necessary structurally?
From a structural standpoint, this absolute darkness is mathematically necessary to create the maximum possible contrast with what happens next. You cannot perceive a sudden burst of light unless you are standing in pitch black.
And that sudden burst of light arrives in the form of three strangers. Just as he hits this rock bottom, looking out the water, feeling completely empty, these three people approach. Which brings us to what we might call the mechanics of a miracle.
The anatomy of a conversion experience.
Yeah. These three people aren't just walking by. The text says Toivo actually sees the joy and peace shining from their faces. And Toivo's immediate reaction is incredibly telling.
He isn't skeptical at all.
No, he doesn't roll his eyes at them. He's jealous. He wishes he could be that happy too.
That jealousy is the crack in his frayed armor. It reveals that beneath the unction and the existential dread, there is a desperate hunger for light.
Right.
So when they approach him and ask, "Have you heard about Jesus?" It doesn't read as aggressive proselytizing. In the context of his extreme despair, it reads as an offering of food to a starving man.
Toivo admits to himself that he had prayed a little bit in the past. So when they ask, "Can we pray for you?" he responds, "Why not?"
But the text makes it clear this isn't just a flippant agreement.
Right. He senses their sincerity and the presence of some spirit, with a capital S.
This is a critical pivot in the narrative. We are shifting from internal psychological realism into the phenomenological reality of a religious experience.
Let's break down phenomenological reality for a second. That essentially means we aren't debating the theology or whether a spirit actually materialized in the air.
Exactly.
We are focusing purely on how the experience feels to Toivo as a lived, subjective reality, right?
That's spot on. We are looking at the direct experience of his consciousness. The American philosopher and psychologist William James wrote extensively about this.
In the varieties of religious experience, right?
Yes, his foundational 1902 book. James studied firsthand accounts of religious conversions and noted that profound spiritual shifts often manifest as intensely physical, involuntary sensations.
Involuntary, meaning they literally can't control their physical reaction.
Exactly. Sudden conversion, in James's view, happens when a subconscious incubation process, like those dream fragments, suddenly bursts into conscious awareness, completely overriding the individual's previous center of energy.
And that is exactly what happens to Toivo. This isn't an intellectual debate where they convince him with logical arguments. They ask if he wants to give his life to Jesus Christ. He says yes, and his body takes over.
It's totally visceral.
He feels a sudden prick in his heart, and he physically collapses. He falls to his knees and breaks down weeping.
Falling to the knees is the universal posture of involuntary surrender. The ego, You know, the self-destructive identity that wore the torn denim jacket is buckling under the weight of an external force.
They place their hands on him, and the text describes it so vividly. It says, "Something like a power descended upon me from heaven, filling my heart with freedom."
It's a huge moment.
As one of them prays, "In the name and blood of Jesus," Toivo experiences a miraculous, instantaneous cessation of his addiction. He realizes he feels as light as a feather and notes that he doesn't crave alcohol anymore.
The neuroscience of a sudden conversion experience is actually fascinating to consider here.
Oh, I'd love to hear about that.
Well, while the text frames it as a supernatural miracle, what Toivo is experiencing maps onto extreme neurological rewiring.
Because of the dopamine.
Yes, exactly. Severe addiction hijacks the brain's reward centers, primarily involving dopamine pathways. A profound, ecstatic, emotional shock, like a sudden religious awakening, can trigger a massive, overwhelming release of dopamine and endorphins that essentially short-circuits the craving mechanism.
Wow.
The void has been instantly filled with a new, overwhelmingly powerful neurochemical and spiritual reality.
That totally explains the feeling of extreme lightness and the sudden vanishing of the cravings. But intertwined with this beautiful internal liberation is an external visual motif that is easily my favorite detail in the story.
The lightning.
Yes. Right after the prayer, Toivo is watching the river flow, and he sees something like heat lightning brighten the sky.
Heat lightning. It is a highly specific, very intentional meteorological phenomenon for the author to invoke.
Right. And we need to talk about why they use this specific imagery instead of just saying lightning.
It changes the whole tone.
It does, because heat lightning isn't actually a different kind of lightning. It's a colloquial term used in the summer to describe flashes of lightning from a thunderstorm that is simply too far away for the observer to hear the accompanying thunder.
Right. So it's silent.
It's silent, distant illumination. So I have to ask you, is the author using it to represent the immense silent power of heaven that just touched his heart? Or is it something more ominous? Like, does it represent a massive shift in the atmosphere, a violent storm brewing on the horizon?
I mean, if we look at the structure of folklore surrounding lightning, and specifically how atmospheric shifts are used in literature dealing with spiritual warfare, it absolutely leans toward the ominous.
Really? Even though it's so beautiful?
Yeah. Heat lightning is beautiful to watch, sure, but it is fundamentally the visible flash of a distant violent storm. It indicates a massive disturbance in atmospheric pressure.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
If we apply that to the story's metaphysical framework, an act of supreme grace, a soul being snatched from the darkness, has just created a shockwave. Toivo's conversion is a massive disturbance in the spiritual atmosphere, and the storm is noticing him.
Okay, let's unpack this. So what does this all mean? Which brings us back to that central thesis we mentioned at the start. Why does profound change trigger a backlash?
That is the million-dollar question.
Because in almost any other inspirational story, this is where the narrative ends, right? The addict finds salvation by the river, feels light as a feather, the storm flashes silently in the distance, and the screen fades to black.
A neat, happy ending.
But this text operates on a terrifying metaphysical principle. The moment Toivo is filled with divine light, he becomes a beacon in the dark. And in this world, light immediately and inevitably attracts predatory darkness.
This is the brutal reversal. And the narrative whiplash here is physically jarring.
It really is. Toivo thanks his new friends, walks away feeling completely liberated, and then in the very next breath, a large gang appears out of nowhere and surrounds him.
The pacing of the sequence is so aggressive. The author provides no transition, no warning. The word suddenly acts as a trapdoor beneath the reader.
And Toivo, still radiating his new peace, doesn't try to fight. He doesn't try to run. He looks at this threatening and circling mob and says, simply, Jesus loves you.
And the response from the gang shatters the new reality Toivo just entered.
The text says a demonic, cackling laughter burst from their mouths. They knock him to the ground and kick him in the face so violently that one of his eyes bursts.
We really have to analyze the profound shock of this violence. We have moved from a serene, heavenly spiritual awakening into visceral, shocking, gory body horror in a single sentence.
It's so abrupt.
And the author ensures we understand the metaphysical stakes by explicitly using the word demonic twice in this tiny section. Demonic laughter, a demonic shout.
So it's not just a random street crime.
No, absolutely not. This is not a random mugging by street thugs. This is a coordinated spiritual counterattack.
The violence is incredibly specific, too. Like, they didn't break his nose or crack a rib. His eye bursts. That it's pure, unadulterated body horror. but conceptually it is loaded with mythological meaning.
Oh, definitely. Throughout human history, eyes are the ultimate symbol of perception, enlightenment, and the soul. To lose an eye is to lose your connection to reality.
It immediately evokes the mythology of sacrifice for me, specifically Odin in Norse mythology.
That's a brilliant connection.
Because Odin famously travels to Mimir's well, the Well of Wisdom, and must sacrifice one of his physical eyes to Mimir in order to take a single drink from the waters of cosmic knowledge.
Right, the ultimate transaction.
Exactly, physical sight in exchange for spiritual sight.
That is a perfect parallel. Toivo gains ultimate spiritual sight by the river. He sees the truth of his salvation, he sees the joy in the strangers' faces, and the demonic forces immediately exact a toll.
They violently rip away his physical sight the moment his spiritual eyes are open.
It is a terrifying, desperate attempt by the darkness to plunge him back into blindness.
And the horror of the scene is amplified by the auditory details. I mean, the story went from silent heat lightning to Toivo howling in absolute agony, clutching a ruptured eye on the concrete.
That's a horrible image.
And over his screams, he hears one of the attackers scream a demonic shout, "An ambulance for Toivo!"
That line is just dripping with theatrical malice. It is a complete perversion of the concept of rescue.
Exactly. When someone yells for an ambulance, it implies that the systems of order and medicine are coming to save the victim.
Right. Help is on the way.
But coming from the mouth of a demonic attacker, it is a sarcastic, cruel mockery. The medical system he is being handed over to is not of this earth. It plunges us directly into the final and undoubtedly most disturbing phase of this deep dive.
We are entering the descent into the macabre.
The text shifts here to a new section, attributed to a different author or perspective, Topi Halttu, and it's titled The Dark Hospital of Vladivostok.
Even the title is chilling.
If the previous section was a sudden spike of violence, this section is a sustained plunge into pure hell.
The grounding realism of the smoke-filled apartment from the beginning is entirely gone at this point.
Right.
We have crossed completely into surreal nightmare logic.
When Toivo wakes up again, which is this dark, twisted mirror of his awakening at the start of the story. But this time, he isn't in his apartment. He is in the back of a black ambulance.
And he's bound to a stretcher.
Right. And the restraints aren't standard nylon or leather belts. The text explicitly specifies they are belts made of human skin.
The introduction of human skin as a material object instantly signals to the reader that we have left the realm of human morality and entered a demonic domain.
Wait, let me push back here for a second.
Sure.
Is the author just trying to gross the reader out with the human skin detail? Like, is it just cheap shock value?
I really think it's far more than shock value. Historically and mythologically, the flaying of skin and the use of human remains as utilitarian objects represents the ultimate desecration of the human form. Well, it strips away personhood. Think of historical atrocities or the darkest folklore of witches and serial killers. By binding Toivo in human skin, the text is declaring that Toivo is no longer viewed as a patient or even a human being.
He's just an object.
He is meat. He's a captive in a slaughterhouse where humanity itself is just raw material.
Oh, that is so dark. That makes the medical professionals in the ambulance even more horrifying. Standing in front of him is a figure described as a nurse from hell.
Yeah, that description.
She grimaces at him, and he can clearly see her bleeding gums, and she's wearing a dirty white suit.
The inversion of archetypes here is staggering. A nurse is supposed to be an archetype of care, sterilization, and healing.
Right, a comforting presence.
Here, she wears a white suit, the color of purity, but is filthy. Her bleeding gums implies severe decay, perhaps scurvy or a body rotting from the inside out. Yet she is the figure of authority. Everything that should comfort him is diseased and corrupt.
But what she does next is easily the most horrific image in the entire text. She takes a needle and thread, and she physically sews his burst eye shut.
It's unbearable to even think about.
And while she does it, she's gnashing her teeth and taunting him, dragging out his name. Toivo, Toivo.
We have to unpack the significance of sewing the eye shut because this is really the thematic climax of the excerpt.
I really want your take on this because is sewing the eye shut merely an act of physical torture to escalate the body horror? Or does it symbolize something much darker? Like, are these forces trying to permanently seal away the literal vision of grace he just received?
It is entirely symbolic, functioning as a dark ritual.
Okay.
The eye was ruptured by the initial attack on the street, which was an act of brute violence. But sewing it shut is a deliberate, methodical, surgical sealing of the wound in a state of darkness.
Wow.
It is an attempt to permanently lock him in physical and metaphorical blindness. And the mocking repetition of his name is the absolute key to understanding this. In Finnish, the name Toivo literally translates to hope.
Oh, wow. Wait, Toivo means hope.
Yes.
That changes the entire reading of the scene.
It really does. So the demonic nurse is literally mocking the concept of hope. Mm. She's gnashing her teeth and saying, "Hope, hoopee," as she sews, "Shut the eye of hope."
That is chillo.
He is trapping him in a dark, diseased ambulance. It is a profound, calculated, metaphysical assault on the concept of salvation itself. The devil is trying to blind hope.
That makes the presence of the driver even more terrifying.
Yeah.
The text gives us a brief but unforgettable look at the driver of this black ambulance.
The ferryman.
Yeah. He's wearing a black tuxedo. He has pitch black eyes. And he doesn't speak directly to Toivo. A deep voice simply speaks through a rusty mesh between the cab and the back.
The black tuxedo is funeral attire. And the driver with pitch black eyes is essentially a modern manifestation of Charon, the ferryman of the underworld from Greek mythology.
Let's explore that Charon connection for the listener. Charon was the ferryman who transported the souls of the newly deceased across the river Styx and into Hades. You had to pay him a coin to cross.
Precisely. This driver is not taking Toivo to a hospital to heal him. He is ferrying a soul across a modern asphalt version of the river Styx.
And the rusty mesh.
The rusty mesh acts as the physical barrier between the realm of the living and the orchestrators of the dead. It's a chilling update to an ancient myth.
But the destination is what truly haunts me. The deep voice speaks an order through the rusty mesh.
What's fascinating here is the final line, Code 6 to Vladivostok.
Mm-hmm.
And right after hearing that, Toivo loses consciousness.
Why Vladivostok? Of all the places in the world, why use that specific real-world location? I mean, Vladivostok is a major port city, but geographically it is located in the extreme Russian Far East, right near the borders of China and North Korea.
It is the absolute terminus of the Trans-Siberian Railway.
It is the end of the line.
It is the geopolitical edge of the world. In the cultural imagination, especially from a Western or Northern European perspective, like Finland, Siberia, and the Russian Far East represent ultimate isolation.
Almost like a wasteland.
Exactly. It evokes the history of the Gulag Archipelago, a freezing, unforgiving exile that is the furthest possible point from the center of the known civilized world.
So, in the context of a supernatural demonic ambulance, Vladivostok isn't a geographical city anymore.
No, it has become a mythic destination. It is a coded coordinate for eternal damnation. It is the gulag of the soul.
Wow.
By giving an actual geographic name to hell, the author grounds the supernatural terror in a very real human fear of freezing isolation.
It's the furthest place imaginable from the warmth of the heat lightning and the joy of the riverside park. It's the ultimate cold, dark exile.
It really is.
And by having Toivo lose consciousness exactly at the pronouncement of that destination, the narrative completely denies you, the reader, any sense of resolution. You are trapped in the back of the ambulance with him, heading into the freezing dark.
It forces the reader to sit with the discomfort of the unresolved tension.
It does. So as we pull back and look at this entire incredible breakneck journey, the pace is just staggering.
It covers so much ground.
We started in the physiological and psychological purgatory of a smoke-filled, hungover apartment. We analyzed the dream symbols of alchemical green stones and spiritual marriage.
Then the search for connection.
Right. We moved through a desperate search for connection that led down to the symbolic threshold of the river. We witnessed the sudden neurochemical and spiritual ecstasy of a conversion experience.
And then the crash.
And then we were immediately thrust into a violent mythological backlash, a burst eye, human skin belts, and a hellish ferryman bound for the freezing exile of Vladivostok.
It demonstrates the immense power of narrative density.
It really does. And for you listening, I think the major takeaway here is that profound storytelling doesn't require hundreds of pages of slow, methodical world building.
No, not at all.
The deepest explorations of human psychology, of the battle between ultimate salvation and ultimate horror, can happen in the space of a few short, violently juxtaposed paragraphs.
That's the beauty of it.
The text proves that when a human being undergoes a radical transformation, the friction between who they were and who they are becoming can generate absolute terrifying heat.
The old self does not die quietly, and the darkness does not surrender its territory without a vicious counterattack.
Exactly. Which brings me to a final, somewhat provocative thought for you to ponder long after we sign off.
Okay, let's hear it.
At the very end of this excerpt, Toivo, whose name means hope, loses consciousness in the back of that black ambulance. His physical eye has been sewn shut by a demonic nurse mocking his name. He is bound by human skin, hurtling toward a destination that symbolizes cold, eternal isolation.
That's a bleak picture.
It looks, by all physical metrics, like an absolute crushing defeat. The backlash won. But considering his realization by the river, that moment where power descended from heaven, short-circuited his addiction, and filled his heart with total freedom, I have to ask.
I won.
Does this darkness actually represent his defeat, or is his physical, bodily torment merely a distraction?
Oh, interesting.
Is it a temporary, albeit horrifying, physical tantrum from the darkness, trying to obscure the fact that, on a spiritual level, his soul has already been liberated? Is the devil in this story just punishing a physical body whose soul he knows he has already permanently lost?
That is the eternal question of the martyr throughout all human history. Does the destruction of the flesh negate the salvation of the spirit?
Right.
The text refuses to answer, leaving the terrifying tension entirely in your hands.
It leaves you in the dark, wondering where the light went. Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us on this intensely surreal, wildly shifting deep dive. We hope it inspired you to look closer at the texts you read, to question the profound shifts in your own life, and to keep exploring the hidden, sometimes terrifying depths of the stories you consume. Until next time, keep your eyes open. Both of them.